You're listening to a forum on U.S. foreign policy and the war on terrorism. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Dr. Biallo is a full professor of international relations and national security at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College and former director of the National Security and Strategy Program. He is also an adjunct professor of government at George Mason University, where he teaches international relations and political philosophy. He joined the U.S. Department of State in 1986 as a foreign affairs officer in the Office of the U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism. At State, he was responsible for initiating, implementing, and executing U.S. policy in the Middle East, North Africa, and the Eastern Mediterranean, including Turkey, Greece, Malta, and Cyprus. Dr. Biallo worked on numerous national security problems, including the former American and Western hostages in Lebanon. He is the recipient of several U.S. government service awards. Dr. Biallo earned his undergraduate degree from San Diego State University, his master's degree from Tufts University in cooperation with the Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy, and his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Biallo has published many book reviews and articles. His latest book was published in 1999 by the Emirates Center for Strategic Studies and Research and is entitled The Strategic Implications of Biological and Chemical Weapons on Gulf Security. Dr. Biallo.
I'm very, very pleased to be here. I want to thank the Greens. I actually didn't know there was a Green Party in the United States, I have to be honest with you, because I teach comparative politics, and I always think of the Green in Europe, you know, in Germany and elsewhere. I suppose I am the breath of fresh air. I'm not going to be coming here to criticize the American policy, or else the State Department would not be sending me out anymore. So I have to somewhat toe the line. It's something I have done literally for almost 20 years now with the United States government. I am in evidence and a true indication that if you come to this country and do the right things and treat people the right way, you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. I grew up in Lebanon. I came to this country when I was very young. I didn't want to go to France. I didn't want to go to England. I had gone to school in Lebanon in a Christian missionary school. Essentially, it was a Quaker school. I learned a lot about the concept of the Quaker religion and so on. And I grew up as a Muslim. So, I mean, essentially, I combine different cultures, and I have my foot in different sort of places. But I'm proud to be in this country. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm honored that this country has given me the opportunity to achieve the kinds of things I've achieved. I don't think I would have been able to do it elsewhere. And I don't think I would have been able to do it had I just not left when I did before the Civil War in that country back in the late 60s. I'm going to, again, sort of focus on what the U.S. policy is, and just to get to have, just to lay the foundation for you to sort of try to understand in a way what happened to us on the 11th of September as a nation, and where are we going from here? Is it likely that we will essentially experience a similar kind of tragedy like this in the future? And I think that's really what's on the mind of many Americans, and I travel all across the country and I talk to people about this issue. It isn't just a question of finding answers to why these things would happen to us. And of course, my colleagues, Professor Dunn and Professor Griffith, sort of alluded to some of these issues. I'm not here to sort of criticize anyone, and this is not meant to be a major debate. Although I'm willing to jump into the fray of things if we have to, but the important thing to keep in mind is I will outline to you what the U.S. policy position is. Things did change after the 11th of September. This was a tragic event that had taken place in our country for whatever reason is the cause. I'm not really getting into it. I'm really going to talk about the policy aspect of it. But I'm here to reiterate what Professor Griffith has said. This was a crime, and I'm really glad to hear, despite his sort of reservations about American democracy, that he does consider, in essence, the attacks of the 11th September as a crime. As a crime against humanity, because that's really how the United States and how the State Department policymakers inside the Beltway essentially view it. It is a crime, and it ought to be addressed essentially as a crime. And prior to the 11th of September, the policy was very clear. I worked on the policy for so many years. I'm still working on the policy even to this day, despite the fact I'm no longer walking the halls of the State Department. I'm still doing it indirectly because I'm still doing a lot of work with task forces out there, and I'm very much connected to the counterterrorism office there. prior to the 11th of September, the way we dealt with terrorism basically is we have really adhered to one important concept that Professor Griffith and my colleague on the panel, Dr. Dunn, has sort of alluded to, and that is essentially the rule of law. States cannot, in essence, give up, especially such as the United States, in which we do have a liberal democracy, to really give up on this, on the rule of law. And that's, in essence, how a liberal democracy prides itself on being a liberal democracy. We must never forget, in essence, whatever we are doing right now in the fight against terrorism, we ought to continue to adhere to the rule of law, and that basically, to reiterate the kinds of points that were made before, because there is really a major misunderstanding on this, that the policy hasn't changed very much from before the 11th of September in the sense, ladies and gentlemen, that we will continue to do our best to protect both human and civil rights on one hand and fight terrorism on the other. And that is really the biggest challenge facing us, the United States, today. It's how you go about balancing these wonderful but very challenging, very conflicting sort of goals and objectives with one another. Not a problem for the United States alone. This is a global problem. It's a regional problem. And it's a regional problem because nations, as Professor Dunn has alluded to, act in terms of states. You know, the world works in terms of units of analysis, and units of analysis basically are states. And states sometimes have all kinds of regional and domestic problems with one another. So it's not very easy, for example, to argue that if you look carefully about how you go about perceiving this threat of terrorism, you come very quickly to the conclusion, look at how states behave and treat one another. The Israelis think the Palestinians are the terrorists. The Palestinians think the Israelis are the terrorists. The Indians think essentially the Pakistanis are the terrorists, and the Pakistanis think the Indians are the terrorists. In Russia, of course, the Chechens think the Russian militaries are the terrorists, and of course, if you are in Russia, it's the Chechens, and so on and so on. You can go on and on and on. The question is, you need to have some kind of operational definition for how you're going to about to proceed when really, in a way, your survival is at stake as a nation. The tragedy of the 11th of September, the reason it went beyond, in essence, simply a crime against humanity, it became, in a way, a threat to our national security interests. And this is why the word, the war on terrorism, was concocted. Only because, really, it's a temporary term. Why is that? Because if you look carefully about how we fought terrorism before the 11th of September, we applied all the elements of powers to it. We just did not highlight the militarism that Professor Griffith has alluded to and Dr. Dan and Dunn. The issue, essentially, prior to the 11th of September, we applied all the elements of power. We applied economic sanctions. We applied, essentially, diplomatic pressures. We applied political pressures. We applied psychological pressures, information, and so on and so forth. And the military was really a very small piece of the tapestry. The only thing about the 11th of September and its aftermath is that the military piece was highlighted a little bit more than the others. But the others are still in operation. Don't ever let anybody sort of convince you that, essentially, this is just a war on terrorism that employs only a military solution to it. Because really this problem, and the State Department understands that, the government understands that, there is no really military solution to it. Terrorism is going to continue to evolve. It's as simple as that. And I think my colleagues, if they said anything right on the mark, is that the world is changing in the sense that we do have kinds of problems and issues right now that did not exist as they did under the Cold War. And that is basically what we are confronted with in the world community today. Are ethnic problems, religious problems, national problems that seem to have highlighted the tensions both domestic, on a domestic level, a regional level, and a global level. And that's how you ought to see the world. One of the most wonderful things about the Green, and I remember when I used to lecture about Western Europe, basically is that the Greens have always thought, you know, think globally but act locally. And that's basically why you're here, to think about the fact that foreign policy really is not made in a vacuum. And I have no problems, essentially, with talking about the perversion of American democracy. The issue is, at least that's our political culture. Yes, we really, if there is a need to change it, then that's what makes this wonderful system the way it is. That is, we have the opportunity and the freedom to be able to change it if we really want to do so. And no one is going to stop us from doing so. And that's what makes the beauty of American democracy and, therefore, of American liberalism so unique. But we should never forget that ultimately that this attack on the 11th of September had really no excuse. It has nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with ethnic conflicts. It's essentially murder, and it's because of murder you are continue to want to apply the rule of law to bring the culprits, the perpetrators of this act, to justice, whether in this country or elsewhere. And we have always gone on the basis that there is no substitute, really, for the rule of law. And it's very, very important to keep to think about it in these terms. So on one hand, when you think about what has happened to us after the 11th of September, ladies and gentlemen, clearly things have changed only in the way we approach the conflict. And it is a form of a conflict in international relations, no doubt about it. That's what terrorism is. I mean, there are a lot of other issues that also create conflict in international relations. That's basically the spread of weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, radiological weapons, nuclear weapons. Those in the wrong hands, under the wrong circumstances, could also lead to mass destruction and therefore to mass casualties. And we understand, in essence, that when you think about fighting terrorism, you're also thinking about fighting a lot of other sort of issues connected to terrorism today. And terrorism doesn't exist in a vacuum. And the responses that I'm going to talk to you about, in essence, right now, will outline what the policy is and where we're actually going with it, because that's very important to try to understand that terrorism, on one hand, it's really a crime, but on the other hand, also is a threat to our national security, and we ought to do something about it. And if we have to highlight the military solution for the time being, so be it, because that's really how you, in essence, protect your survival as a nation. When we talk about, in essence, this is a threat to our national security, what happened to us, we're talking about the fact that the very fabric of our society is going to be essentially threatened, and the government saw fit, not just the president, but the government saw fit, as it has seen for the last 30 years. This is nothing new for us. People who have been practicing and working on the issue of counterterrorism and anti-terrorism have been working these issues for many, many years. We have never seen this attack at this magnitude in this country, really, at all before. And the amount of people that died on the soil, on our soil, on the 11th of September, basically fell short of what happened in Vietnam during the Civil War. I mean, it was just a magnificent event in the way we do it in our history, and it needed a very drastic, different way of approaching the problem. Okay, so the normal thing of bringing people to justice had to take a second seat to doing something else. We will continue to bring people to justice when we're able to track them down around the world. But no matter how you look at it, the cornerstone of U.S. policy in the counterterrorism field and the anti-terrorism field rests on a very important concept, and that concept is international cooperation. We don't do things in a vacuum. You know, we may be an imperial power, but certainly we have constraints and restraints in the way we do things. And we cannot essentially simply act irresponsibly unilaterally around the world without the support and the help of our friends and allies around the world. So international cooperation is a very important part and parcel of what we do. And if nations disagreed with us, they won't be helping us. We wouldn't have been able to crack this case in Pakistan or in Nigeria or in Dar es Salaam or in Nairobi, as Professor Dunn knows very well, without the support and help of our friends and allies. It's impossible. We don't act in a vacuum. We have limitations, major limitations as a great superpower, as an imperial power, if you want to use that term. And it's very important to understand that. Juxtaposed to that argument is something that Professor Griffith has alluded to. And that is essentially we ought to look at what we're doing here in this country. And what we're doing in this country, in essence, in the fight against terrorism that requires a domestic response is, of course, people like you who have to support the policy, who has to sustain it. Why? Because this second stage that we're embarking on right now, in order for it to succeed, not to defeat terrorism, ladies and gentlemen, because you can never defeat terrorism. You need to understand that right here and now. You can contain it. You can manage it. You can make it smaller, perhaps, but you can't defeat it. But the most critical point to keep in mind is that you need to, in order for you to contain it and manage it, you must have a sustainable strategy, a strategy that would keep the coalition together. You have to be, therefore, responsive to the laws, regulations, demands of other players in the international system. And Professor Dunn and Professor Griffith understand that very well from what they've said to me so far. It's very, very important to understand that. We don't function in a vacuum. The UN doesn't have to go along with us on a lot of these resolutions. If they didn't want to do it, they would have debated it. They would have vetoed it. It's not as if, in essence, we're putting a gun to their heads to vote in a certain way, or the international community, or those people that help us. So there is a semblance of support because people in the world understand that this is not an American problem only. It's a global problem. It's likely to happen anywhere in the world. It used to be during the Cold War that only open societies were vulnerable, as what happened, of course, in Europe in the 60s and 70s and the 80s, where terrorism was rampant, in essence, in the in Western European countries. Today, everybody is vulnerable. Everybody. Closed, open societies, they are all vulnerable because of the globalization issues that were raised here this afternoon. And that's, I think, is very important to understand. These are the changes that are taking place. Now, the issue right now before me is, what do we do about it? What is the U.S. government doing about this threat? International cooperation, yes. Interagency on the domestic level, interagency coordination, yes, because that's important. The FBI must be able to talk to the CIA. CIA must be able to talk to the first responders. Even the fire department at the local community in Auburn is going to be involved at one point in the future, because that's the name of the game, an interagency coordination approach to it. FBI doesn't act in a vacuum. It cannot act in a vacuum, because the first responders are not going to be the FBI. It's going to be the fire department and the police department. It's going to be the local community. It's going to affect them the first. And God forbids, in a time when we are talking about chemical and biological weapons, it might even be too late by the time the federal government arrives. Okay, so what are we going to do about it? Well, what have we done? From a military perspective, let's take the military dimension first. We have divided this fight against terrorism into three categories. At the strategic level, the United States must continue to keep that coalition together. That's at the strategic level. At the operation level, what are we doing? We want to basically, just outline the policy, we want to make sure that terrorist groups around the world, not just the Qaeda, not the Osama bin Laden type, but every terrorist organization, loses its safe haven. We want to make sure that they don't have a place to hide. We want to make every country in the world accountable for hiding, providing safe haven, training facilities to terrorist groups. We want to hold them accountable. It's as simple as that. Whether we can take on the world because of that, that's a different issue altogether. But the key issue here before us is that countries are going to be held accountable between now and the future, because that's the only way you're going to reduce the safe haven and safe training, the training facilities and the safe haven facilities for terrorist groups. The second important part of that second level, so the first strategic level is maintain, ladies and gentlemen, a sustain a coalition against terrorism. At the operational level, you want to get rid, in essence, of safe havens around the world, hold states accountable for their actions if they host terrorist groups or training facilities. And most importantly, at the second level, the operation level, make sure you go after the finance. Go after the money. Where is the money trail? Where is the money coming from? We want to be able to drain that lake. Make sure there isn't any money, in essence, to be used against non-combatants. And you have noticed what I've done so far. I have defined to you, generally speaking, that we define terrorism as a politically motivated act against non-combatants, against civilians. That's the basic definition of it. And that's important to understand. Now, at the tactical level, of course, now we're talking about the strategic, operational, and tactical. At the tactical level, we want to go after the terrorist organizations themselves and destroy them. Because I think, basically, if you're going to continue to have these types of organizations running around and active, they're going to hit us again. We are vulnerable, no doubt about it. Globalization has made us more vulnerable. Okay, and terrorists are not going to hit you, in essence, where you're strong. They're not going to take you on face to face. They're not going to take us on force. It's not a military campaign in that sense. So don't jump on this idea it's a war. It's really not a war per se, because basically they're going to hit us where we're most vulnerable, not where we're most strong. So they're not going to hit us at our center of gravity as much, militarily speaking. They're not going to go on force, but they will hit us, in essence, where we are really. They're going to try to get us underneath our belly, where we are really the soft underbelly, because that's where we're soft. So they're very resourceful, and they can do it. Okay? They have access to the internet. They have access to communications. They can travel around the world, and they've got the money. So we need to deprive them of all of these set of factors. So we want to crack down on terrorist financing. This is extremely important right now. We want to be able to share intelligence increasingly. And that has happened. By the way, since the 11th of September, we have had countries and we have cooperation with countries on intelligence area, in the intelligence area, in terms of exchanging information that we've never had before. Libya has come out of the woods essentially to help us out. Yemen, a lot of countries around the world who basically in the past we have Sudan, for goodness sake. I mean, Sudan is on the state list of countries that support terrorism. All of these countries are coming out of nowhere to try to help us out, and the key to it is to enhance intelligence coordination. And that's happening even more and more after the 11th of September. Is it because we're an imperial power? Is it because we're not? No. I honestly think because voluntary nations believe, in essence, that their well-being and their security is very much tied up to this global security and stability that Professor Dunn had alluded to. And I think that's important. I mean, you know, international trade thrives on security and stability. You can't have international trade when there's chaos around the world, when people are shooting at one another. We know very well that the world is anarchistic. It's an anarchistic world out there. There's no one government that has more power over everybody else's government. And we know every once in a while, even our friends and allies give us a hard time on a lot of things. Today, one of the biggest things that are going on in terms of our friends and allies, especially in Europe, they're questioning, you know, the way, quote-unquote, the detainees are being treated in Cuba. I mean, they are raising hell over it. And that's likely to change our behavior as well and try to adjust certain things. Why? Because, as I told you, we don't function in a vacuum. We don't. We cannot. And I'm speaking again from experience. So that's very important to keep in mind in the long term. There's another aspect of it that we haven't talked about, and I don't want to spend very much time on this, but I found this to be really important in the long term, because very few people who criticize U.S. policy in the fight against terrorism, I like to call it a fight, because that's really what it is. It's not a war, okay? So that's a very important way of putting it. It's a fight. It's a quarrel, okay? People have differences, cultural differences, ethnic differences, national differences, religious differences, and they fight. Well, heck, a husband and wife fight, girlfriend and boyfriend fight. So, that's just the nature of things. You can't get rid of conflict. But in my judgment, where the policy is going, where it has gone, really for the last, 15, 20 years right now, is we continue to search for avenues to try to reduce conflict. Conflict resolution is very much part and parcel in the fight against terrorism. And the policy itself has moved in that direction on many, many fronts. When it can do it, it will do it. When it can't do it, it cannot do it. We can't do everything. As I told you, we have constraints and restraints. And that's, I think, is very important. But to think about terrorism and the fight against terrorism in terms of simply war, I think it misses the point. Because when we think about a strategy, you're thinking about using a military solution, a political solution, a diplomatic solution, a psychological solution, all at once. An economic solution, they all have to work in concert with one another. They all have to be in sync with one another. And that's a challenge that you face when you're making policy inside the Beltway. Why is that, Dr. B? Because when the stakes are so high, and I'm speaking from experience, when the stakes are so high and terrorism, the attack on our soil on the 11th of September indicated that the stakes were very high, ladies and gentlemen, you seldom have very good choices. You're picking from very bad choices. Because that's just the way things are. Because the players, there are too many cooks in that kitchen. Too many cooks in that kitchen spoils the meal after a while. So you're going to have to take some initiative. You got to do something because the American people and the world community demands it. We are looking for the root causes of terrorism. Yes, the 11th of September has put even more pressure on policymakers, the State Department, the government, to try to look at some of the root causes of these things. That's why we're going back to Afghanistan and saying, well, we want to rebuild that society. We want to help rebuild the society, not just by ourselves. We want to at least be the leaders to try to bring together and in the international community to focus on this problem. And we're going to be doing the same thing with the Arab-Israeli conflict, trying to stop that cycle of violence from going on that Dr. Griffith has talked about. Because when there is a cycle of violence, people aren't talking to one another. There is no dialogue. The idea here of this panel is to encourage dialogue and discourse amongst ourselves so that you guys could think globally and act locally. Because we are sensitive to your needs. We are sensitive to what the American people have to say on a lot of these issues. But you have to take the lead. We can't take the bull and push it over to the water. You guys have to take the bull by the horn and move it to the water because it's your fight as well. And that's the important thing to keep in mind. Yes, we are looking at conflict resolution things as part of this fight. We are looking at the root causes. It isn't just a military conflict. It's not militarism by itself. It's a whole piece, a lot of moving parts of this fight, and I think it's very, very important to keep that in mind. In conclusion, what is it that we really need to do as a country, as a nation? What I'm trying to really say this afternoon is never give up our values. never forget our principle as a great nation, as a nation essentially that really adheres to constitutional liberalism. We want to be vigilant without being paranoid. And that's a very difficult thing to do at time of crisis, when the stakes are high, ladies and gentlemen. We want to be able to be firm, because we do have the will. We want to be vigilant without paranoia. We want to be able to be cautious without panicking. And I think that's really important to keep in mind in the fight. And firmness really provides us, and we need to be firm, because firmness provides us no guarantee whatsoever. But in my judgment, it is far less dangerous, to be honest with you, than allowing the belief that Americans can be assaulted with impunity. The fight against terrorism, and again, I'm calling it a fight, is not one of armies against one another. And I've stressed that to you this afternoon. And I speak from the heart when I come here to talk to you. It is one of values in my judgment, in the judgment of the United States government. It's one of values versus emotions. It is one of reason versus hate. It's one of faith versus fear. It is not a clash of civilization, as Huntington would have said in his Foreign Affairs article. It's not essentially monolithic fight between two different cultures, one Christian and one Muslim. It is really a clash of civilization versus anarchy and lawlessness. And that's what terrorism is all about. And that's what we need to continue to fight against in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Biala. Discussion of foreign policy is best done in quiet places like this. It is critically important to discuss policy, but another thing altogether being the actual instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Veterans understand the difference better than anyone else. Our final speaker today is Frank L. Hood, who retired from the United States Air Force at the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. Mr. Hood's military service spans from March 1954 to July 1974. During that time, he also completed a Bachelor of Business Administration from Campbell College in North Carolina. His aeronautical ratings are navigator and senior pilot. He served in Vietnam from June 1968 through July 1969 as Commander, Detachment 2, of the 556th Reconnaissance Squadron at Cam Ranh Bay, Republic of Vietnam. He has also served as a navigator instructor and piloted B-47s and C-130s. He was an operations officer of the 40th Tactical Airlift Squadron and Chief of Tactical Operations of the 464th Tactical Airlift Wing. Since 1974, Frank Hood has run Frank Hood Antique Restorations and Handmade Reproduction Furniture. He has also worked as an agricultural pilot and a writer and administrator of housing and urban development grants. In addition to reproduction furniture, Mr. Hood builds and repairs wooden boats and is a partner of North River Boat Works. Mr. Hood's community service includes a 20-year membership in the Free School Community in Albany, New York, and 6 years of volunteer staff work for the Journal for Living, a 64-page quarterly magazine. Frank L. Hood is the National Board Secretary of Veterans for Peace and President of the Tom Paine Chapter of that organization in Albany. He has joined in solidarity the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Frank Hood.
It's an honor and a privilege to come here to speak to you today. It's also a little daunting to follow people like Kevin and Bill and Kamal. These are people who've dedicated a great deal of their time to obtaining and organizing factual information. And I would have to say that I don't do that myself every day. I operate more out of my heart. And so what you're going to hear is going to come from my heart. A lot of what's been said here today is stuff that I had jotted down to say to you. So you're talking to someone who spent 20 years in the military. About two-thirds of the way through that 20 years, I did a hitch in Vietnam, and It was a bit before I did that hitch that I started occasionally, not very often, admitting to myself that we as a nation were saying one thing and doing another in Vietnam. I'm glad Dr. Bailo said what he said about the opportunities that the United States offers and the values and ideals that we espouse. Because it's very true what he said, but it's also, I'm afraid, that my perception that we speak these values and ideals, but often miss the mark in carrying them out. And I believe our missing the mark internationally in our foreign relations, our relations with others, is one of the things that's brought terrorist attack within our borders. Another one is that change is just happening, and terrorism is one of the current ways in our world climate that force and violence can be brought to bear to try to achieve change. It was mentioned that I'm associated with Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace has a list of its purposes, but basically what it is we know about war firsthand, we know about the military firsthand, and we want to teach the costs of war and, if at all possible, limit war to only the absolute necessary use as a defense of the nation. I would say, I won't say any more in that direction. Our security has really been rattled by the tragedy of September 11th. Or has it? We were already insecure. Now we know it. So I guess psychologically we're less secure, but in actuality we were already very insecure. Part of the reason we are, I was very interested in the fact that Dr. Dunn was so open about our imperial condition. We act like, or we think from the interior, that we're a sovereign democracy. But we act out in the world like an imperial power. I didn't realize this until maybe 5 years ago when I walked with a Buddhist peace walk through the Philippines and got to see firsthand the results of our imperial force applied in a country. Got to talk to the people that had been under our imperial thumb for some time. So we're acting like imperialists out in the world. As Dr. Griffin said, we've bombed numerous countries. I believe we've bombed or invaded or missiled some 26 countries during the 50-odd years since the end of World War II. Our record is pretty violent, and I'm with Bill Griffin that though we may have attributed noble reasons to what we've done, those bombings are not noble actions. And they make people angry with us. I had no doubt as to why people were angry enough with us to strike at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on the day that it happened. Was I surprised? Yes, because anything like that will take you by surprise. I was horrified, and I was equally horrified at our leadership's immediate use of war rhetoric. I think we would have done so much better to have named it what Dr. Bailo admits it is, a terrible crime against humanity. And then, instead of really forcing coalition ourselves unilaterally, I think that we should have gone to the United Nations, because I think that one of the solutions to our security and the security of the rest of the world is to now realize that little by little we need to segue into world government. Globalization is going to happen no matter what we do, but the form of globalization that's happening now, driven by one major imperial power whose motivations are driven by corporate wealth, is going to cause a great deal of anger among all the other nations, particularly the poor nations, because justice and equity get left by the wayside. These are ideals that I know the people in this room hold dear, but outside our borders, justice and equity are not our consideration, nearly so much as the support of corporate wealth, the support of political power. So to regain security to some degree, I think we need to look at ourselves in a mirror very, very carefully. I think details have been covered well today, so I don't have a lot more to say, except that this is a crisis time. We may emasculate our democracy, finish the emasculation of it, pardon me for a sexist direction there, but we may finish it. Ramsey Clark will tell you that we don't have a democracy now, we're living in a plutocracy. We may finish it internally because we're killing all the, or really endangering, let me not be overstressed in this, we're endangering our rights to freedom in the name of preserving freedom. It seems ridiculous to me. I'd laugh, but I'm afraid I'd cry. So it's a crisis time. It's a time for self-examination. It's a time not for blind unity, but for really thinking about what we believe is truth in what's going on, and then acting on it. The blind unity that was called for 4 months ago angered me a great deal. It didn't allow that we were thinking human being. To close, it is a crisis time. The Chinese character for crisis carries both the meanings of danger and of opportunity. It's a time of opportunity. It's a time of opportunity to make changes that are really, really needed. If we don't make them, I see things only going down from here.
Thank you, Frank Hood, and thank you to all our speakers.
I would also like to say that the Enron crisis brings to mind the grip of corporate control over our government, and I'm very proud that the Green Party does not take one dime of corporate contributions from anybody. That's standard policy of our party. And now we'd like to have questions and comments. Our moderator, Mr. Spina, will kind of lay out the ground rules for that, and then we can start.
Thank you. The floor is open for questions and comments.
And I've not got it all together yet, so bear with me. I think the room is full of people who have looked in the mirror, and we're looking for the opportunities and danger and the change that might help us overcome what we found in the mirror. And so then I'd like to turn to Dr. Griffiths' comments at the end, and have you each explore and comment with us on what it would look like if the Peace Corps had been stronger in Afghanistan when Carter was supporting subversively folks who supported the Soviets. Those ideas of how education is going to look in Afghanistan, if this idea of change that I think we in the room are hoping for. Thank you.
Well, I think the limitation of the Peace Corps is that it has, for some reasons, attempted to remain apolitical. So if you were wanting to drill a well in your host country, that would be acceptable. But if you started to make some sort of an analysis of the corruption of the local hierarchy or something, so it's limited as what it could do, but it's better than sending missiles and fighter bombers over there, obviously. Along the line, I was pleased to hear Dr. Bello representing the State Department and when characterizing the war and violence, and but also somewhat frustrated because I don't, even though you represent the State Department, I've never heard the State Department or anyone in higher levels of U.S. government or the Pentagon ever accept the fact or admit that the U.S. has perpetrated any terrorism in any part of the world. And yet, it would be overwhelmingly naive to suggest that that hasn't been the case. We just have to rename it. We say violence in the name of. And then for us, it doesn't make it terrorism, but for everybody else in the world, it's terrorism. And I guess if this were a debate, I guess the two questions I would ask would be, one is, has the State Department or anyone ever admitted that our government has in the past or has now committed an act of terrorism? And then the second question, which I think I tried to deal with in my remarks, was you said that violence or threat of violence or a military or a quarrel, whatever we want to call it, bombing is quite a heavy quarrel. But anyway, what I think we have to at some point talk about what national interest was served. This term to say national interest, it assumes that it equally benefited every member of America. And I know that in past wars and past expenditure on violence, it hasn't helped the people who are destitute, the people who are struggling to make ends meet. And to send out one more example of violence. So I think we have to get a little more disciplined when we say we have done things for our national interest. The national interest has resulted in those tremendous inequities that I laid out in my remarks. That is, it is in the national interest for CEOs to make 571% more within 10 years. So that troubles me when you use in a cavalier way the national interest. I think we have to be much more precise when we say whose interest. The whole nation isn't sitting in a chair out there saying, ah, that's in my interest. The whole nation is much more complex than that.
Thing too.
And to do that which is correct, man was given the will because God gave it to us. And I'm sure most of us noticed whose picture is here because we know the higher court is definitely keeping the list and checking it twice. But anyway, I would like to address to the representative from the State Department why we're not members of the World Court.
Why we're not?
Members. Or why we are, because the other countries are, as you know.
Depending essentially on the issue. The question also has a lot to do, in essence, why is it that we don't do things within the UN? I mean, basically, the current sanctions against Iraq aren't simply American sanctions. They are really UN sanctions. If you look carefully about sort of the different sanctions against the Taliban, they were all UN sort of sanctions. So we do work with the UN essentially to try to could provide the unity. And the president, as he said last November, this fight is really binding on all nations, not just the United States. So in terms of the adherence to international law, we adhere to it. We believe in it. I'm not answering the question properly, but we're, as I said, we're a nation in essence that adheres to the rule of law. We will continue to do so in terms of our policy.
Just one quick, back to the real history as opposed to official history. I have here documentation of votes in the United Nations in the past 20-25 years, and there are 12 pages, single-spaced, year by year, of when the votes in the UN were 100 and something to 1 or 2. And the United and they were votes having to do with environmental concerns, human rights, investigations of what was happening in the world. And the United States has stood alone in terms of world opinion. And again, in terms of the relationship to the world court, we are the only nation state that has stood before that docket and been judged guilty, and we ignored that verdict because we had the power to do it. And that was after our exploits in Nicaragua in the 1980s. So the question is well taken, because we have, irregardless of the official word that's out, we have, when it was in our interest, back to national interest, we have stood outside of and beyond the international community, to the extent of even refusing to fund it for years until we were so embarrassed that we had to come up with something. So we are not distinguished at all in terms of the U.S. working with other nations. We have been the renegade, we have been the bandit, we have been the outsider, clearly.
Yeah, I'll just briefly make some comments. I think the international law issue is really important, and I want to pick up on a few things that Professor Biallo mentioned. It's not a debate. I want to just very respectfully disagree with a number of things that you said. But I think the main point that the professor made about that the United States does adhere to the rule of law is true, as he follows up, depending on the issue and the subject, right? And we thwart international law when it's convenient for us to, as do other states. This is nothing that, the United States is not the sole bad guy here about international law and renegade, being a renegade. But there's an important point I want to bring out in, that came out in terms of language. And again, respectfully disagreeing, it's important to recognize the U.S. government's not a monolith. The State Department and the current administration, in fact, is probably the most active multilateralist and willing to work with international law and organizations than, say, the CIA, Department of Defense. So respectfully approaching this, the conversation about why this was not labeled a crime against humanity is really important. George W. Bush did not call this a crime against humanity. He called this a declaration of war. So crime against humanity, we'd have to follow certain legal standards and arrest the criminals and put them on trial. We weren't going to do that. We don't trust international court of law in this situation, right? We're about to see reasons why with Milosevic. So it was a war, but it's not a war now, right? It's a fight against terrorism. Well, why is the language now changing to it's a fight against terrorism? Well, if it's a war against terrorism, those people hooded, manacled in Cuba would be war criminals. But they're not war criminals, right? They're detainees, right? Notice the shift of the language, because we don't want to adhere to certain international law when it's inconvenient for us to, right? And this is definitely what's being worked on here. So
the difference between international law when it comes down to bringing people to justice, our situation has always been, we want, in essence, either people to extradite individuals to stand trial, especially if they attack American interests abroad or even the United States, to extradite them to the United States to stand trial in the United States, or to basically to send them to a country in which there is a rule of law that very much adheres to certain kinds of standards to protection of human and civil rights.
I understand that part of the town meeting is an opportunity for us to give thoughts to be carried back to Washington, and Dr. Biallo was offered to do that. So I have a list of concerns that I would like to be brought back to Washington. First concern is I'm concerned about the moral implications of a government that is willing to threaten several million refugees by suspending food shipments across the border before the bombing started, and how that calculated into our plan. And I'm also concerned about how refugees in Afghanistan are doing now. Are they being fed? There's a complete news blackout. How many people are actually dying? I'm concerned that we have no information about casualties in the official media or from the government. I'm concerned about John Ashcroft threatening U.S. citizens when they disagree with the government. I'm concerned that we cannot participate in democracy if things are done in secrecy, because we are to inform our representatives, and the government is ideally to work for us and carry out the will of the people. I'm concerned that in the war in Iraq, that we actually made a war on the Iraqi people. The government is still in power. Saddam Hussein is still there, but women, children, and the elderly are dying. Approximately 600,000 by one figure. Scott Ritter gives us a figure of 5,000 people a month, over 1 million casualties, deaths, since we began the war in Iraq, which hasn't ended. In terms of foreign policy, I'm concerned about terrorist training camps in the United States, such as the School of the Americas, presently under the name of the Western Hemisphere Institute Security Cooperation. There were manuals with torture instruction. There were manuals containing subversion of democracy instructions. I'm concerned that we have terrorized all of Central America and much of South America, and that this is continuing presently today in the war in Colombia with U.S. military aid. I have a concern about the militarization of our high schools. I'm concerned that children will not receive a good education, have a limited ability to think, because they've been shortchanged by what is, in military documentation, a recruitment program. I'm concerned with the suspension of civil liberties and John Ashcroft's memo, which has, in effect, quashed the Freedom of Information Act, again, because we cannot find out the truth of what our government is actually doing. Thomas Mann gave us this wonderful quote that war is only a cowardly escape from the problems of peace. I'm concerned that our government isn't capable of, one, telling us the truth, and two, dealing honestly and capably with the problems of peace, escaping in a cowardly way into one war after the next. And I hope you would bring that to Washington. Thank you.
You've been listening to a forum held recently in Auburn, sponsored by the Green Party of the Finger Lakes and the Syracuse Peace Council. Thanks to Kim and Nancy Gilbertson for providing this material to us.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Yeah.